It's winter time. When temperatures go down, the likelihood goes up that your furnace and other appliances go down with them. So don't risk a costly replacement. Stay comfortable with coverage on the appliances you depend on most with the Service Guard Appliance Repair Program from Black Hills Energy. It's peace of mind in a plan. Visit blackhillsenergy.com/signup to learn more.
With one of the best savings rates in America, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than choosing Slash to be in your band.
Next up for lead guitar. You're in.
Cool.
Yep, even easier than that. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
DIY and Howe Studios presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music, culture, technology, and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
Hello, my fellow diggers, and welcome back to Deeper Digs in Rock, a production of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Christian Swain, that's me, and I am right here behind the mic in San Francisco. Deeper Digs is the companion podcast to the Rock and Roll Archaeology Podcast, or as we like to call it, the RNRIP around here. Deeper Digs, as you might well guess, is where we stop and dig into it a little bit to look closer at people, places, topics that tie in with our larger story of rock and roll. All of our podcasts, and we've got a nice little family going now, are available at rockandrollarchaeology.com. Podcasts, show notes, social media links, and our personal favorite, the donate link. Please stop by. Oh yeah, that's all the business. What time is it? Now. Today's guest is Richard Lloyd. Here is something off his 1979 solo album, Alchemy. That's Misty Eyes by Richard Lloyd. Richard is a really special and criminally underrated guitarist, and he was a founding member of the seminal band Television. Television is also sorely underrated. They didn't generate big sales or go out on arena tours, but they punched way above their weight in terms of how innovative and influential they were and still are. Television gets labeled as a proto-punk band, and they did come out of the late 70s New York City punk scene, but really, they defy labels. Their 1977 debut album, Marquee Moon, is quirky and neurotic, full of short, punchy songs, but any resemblance to the Ramones or the Sex Pistols ends right there. If you forced us to label it, we might call it progressive punk. Lots of energy and attitude, but the playing on Marquee Moon is clean, jazzy, and sophisticated, even delicate at times. Richard Lloyd and Tom Verlaine didn't fall into defined roles like rhythm guitarist and lead guitarist. They just played together, weaving, syncopating, juxtaposing. It's really, really special. When it was released, Marquee Moon was well received by the critics. That's how we heard about it way out here in California. Robert Hilburn gave it a great review in the LA Times. Sales at the time were unspectacular, but Marquee Moon has never been out of print, and it still shows up all the time on the various greatest albums lists. We'll talk about Marquee Moon and the 1978 follow-up Adventure. We'll also get into Richard Lloyd's solo debut, another underrated gem titled Alchemy. On October 24th, 2017, Richard Lloyd published his autobiography, Everything is Combustible. Friends, we read a lot of these books, memoirs and bios and anything about rockers. This one is especially good, a terrific read, and we draw Richard out a little bit on that too. It's a really interesting, wide-ranging interview, so let's get right to it. Welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock, Richard Lloyd. We're so glad to have you and some of your time today to discuss a naked lunch of a book, Everything is Combustible.
Well, I thank you for having me with you and look forward to talking with you.
Yeah, so after all these years and with an obvious talent for crafty writing, why did you decide to write this book? Was it cathartic? Was it difficult or easy? Did the words flow?
Well, the words flew and they flowed. I don't know the past tense of flow. Flowed.
Flowed. Yeah.
And it was pretty easy because I have a voice recognition software that works very well. I didn't actually type a single thing because when I first got a keyboard and realized that typing was back, and I'd had it in high school and didn't like it there, QWERTY. And it was giving me wrist problems.
Right.
So I went out and I bought some software to turn your voice into typing.
Mm-hmm.
It's improved over the years. So now it's like a pretty good secretary, except you have to speak the pronunciation comma, so that your sentences are complete, period, new paragraph. You have to think like that.
Right. You had to learn a technique so that it would come out correctly and be legible after you're done.
That's right.
It's
a kind of language adjustment that you have to make.
Yeah, so it's a memoir style. These vignettes. You kind of even though it flows chronologically, it does go back and forth in time a little bit, right?
Yes, it does. It's based upon vignettes that my memory would come up with, and I would put them down on a document and title them Richard's Memoir. The Velvet Meets Jimmy story, or the Television Goes Into the Studio story, and then I would compile them till I had enough to, I had like more than 400 pages.
Right.
Sent samples off, and actually I sent a sample off to Norton and I got the wrong lady. She was doing agricultural books. And she told me to talk to the rock and roll people, but she didn't know who they were. So I sort of procrastinated some more. And then I did a foreword on a book about John Lennon as viewed from the perspective of the Gurdjieff teaching. And it was called John Lennon, A Life Something. I wrote the foreword for it. So I asked the guy, are you interested in any of these vignettes? I have these hundreds of stories. And he said, absolutely. And when he got a load of them, he really, really liked them, said, I'd love to publish this. So we put together a manuscript, and that became the book.
Yeah, and it is a lengthy book. It's it's 400 pages, it's quite an honest, no holds barred look at your life, warts and all. So, us have at least one.
Warts.
What's that?
I don't call them warts. Other people might. I call them experiences.
Right,
Right. And, you know, over time, the longer you live, those things build upon us. So, you know, all of us have at least one book in us. And, you know, you actually sat down and banged it out. And I love the line, the story of an old soul acting like a juvenile delinquent on a reform school planet.
Well, that's what I think that's where we're at. But for some people, it's a grade school. Some people it's kindergarten, some people it's college, and some people it's a penitentiary. You know, it depends on where you're coming from.
Right, and how we take it all in and how we adjust to the experiences. You know, every choice leads to another set of choices, and you know, you're beholden to all the choices that you've made in the past.
One of the things I like to say is that the biggest problem in the world is that people take themselves personally.
Yeah, that's good. So you were born in Steel Country, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You were raised Catholic, lapsed, as you say, but it seems there was a lot going on in that newly born brain of yours. Can you talk a little bit about how you look at life very different from a very young age?
Well, I looked up and I saw people that I could see their emotions. And I could see I could almost read their thoughts. And I remember wondering, how come I know what they're saying? I haven't learned their language. You know, and this is when I was months old. And
so your memories go all the way back to almost the moment of your birth.
Probably in the womb memories.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these sensations of having been in a place of greater freedom. You know, in the womb, you're floating in the amniotic fluid, and there might be an aftertaste of that left behind after you come down the birth canal. And for most people, they meet with a forgetter. There's Lethe, or the guardian angel comes and presses then puts this little mark in the Jewish Apocrypha. This little mark is to go shh, so you don't know what cards you're going to be dealt in life.
The indentation between your nose and your upper lip.
That's right. That indentation is supposed to make you forget what you've done beforehand and allow you to play life, you know, fair and square.
So you got missed.
Well, I don't think that they pushed very hard or... Or they missed, yeah, or they went to the side or something like that. Because I always have had this sense that this is not the only plane, especially being born into a clumsy, little, chubby body that wouldn't obey my will. You know, it wouldn't fly. It wouldn't stand up till I was, you know, 5-6 months old and had to sweat my way up the sides of the crib. And I remember it very distinctly.
Uh-huh.
I remember all the colors, the textures of the living room and the slats on the crib and standing up and my head wobbling because my head was too big for the neck muscles.
Yeah.
My legs were twitching and wobbling and my hands let go of the slats, and I thought, oh no, I'm going to lose consciousness if I fall. And I remember I fell back on my diaper, and I rolled back on my back, and I hit my head, and I heard bong. Not bells or stars, but, you know, I got zonked. But I looked around, and I was conscious, and I hadn't lost consciousness, and that was very important to me. I was deadly afraid of losing consciousness. I don't know why at that point, but I looked at both my hands and I took my left hand and I made a fist out of it with my volition, which it would obey. And I was suddenly struck with this enormous, what do you call those moments? Existential moment.
The epiphany?
An epiphany beyond an epiphany. But like one thought is a piano note. This was like a gigantic chord.
Like the end of Day in the Life.
The end of the day of the life. Yeah, sure. The beginning of the life.
No, I mean the Beatles song, The End of the Day.
I know what you mean. Trust me, I know what you mean. But what I'm saying is that there was the thought that I had to grow up and I had to learn language and I had to learn to stand and walk and run and do all these things amongst all these other people who were grown up. And they didn't seem to be right in the head to me or in the gut to me. They seemed that what they were saying didn't agree with what they were feeling. And so I got the impression that they were asleep or unconscious or daydreaming or lying, whether purposefully or and to themselves as well. And they accepted the human limitations, you know, that people go by in life.
And you recognize this from a very young age.
From a very young age, yeah. It's the first thing I recognized.
It's very unusual, very special.
Well, I don't know if I'm special, but, you know, I can see myself from outside myself. A permanent out-of-body experience.
Permanent, which maybe led to some other things in your life that you had to deal with to live in that state. So you moved to Greenwich Village, I guess just as the area is blowing up in the Beats, the folky, and the early rock periods, right?
Yep, in the 50s, middle 50s. I mean, I was 6 years old, so it had to have been 56 or 7. 57 or 8, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the 60s came and everything blew up.
By
the time I grew up with it. I was too young to be a beatnik, a little too old to be a hippie. So I was in that gray area in between. I was neither. And my compatriots were neither either. We became heads.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be a jock. I didn't want to be I was studious, but I didn't want it to cripple my freedom.
Yeah, now you went to Stuyvesant, right?
Stuyvesant.
Stuyvesant. I'm sorry, I'm a West Coaster. I can get that wrong.
Stuyvesant, yes. The guy who bought, you know, Manhattan Island or a part of it with apparently, you know,
$25, right.
$24 worth of trinkets, but they weren't trinkets. They were knives, pots, pans, valuable things to the natives that they didn't have that would help them in their life. I mean, it wasn't just like Mardi Gras costume jewelry, I don't think. Anyway, there's a rock in Inwood Park at the top of Manhattan that commemorates the place where the Shirokapok Indians sold or gave him the permission to use a bit of swamp, mosquito-infested downtown in order to dock. And that's where it all started. Well, Stuyvesant High School is one of the top. At the time, it was all boys, and it was all science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I loved it.
Yeah, yeah, quite the high school.
Love to learn, love science, still love chemistry and physics and astrobiology and all those kinds of things. So nuclear physics, I'm crazy about it.
Yeah, that comes through in the book. You're quite the student. You'll go deeply into any subject and become kind of obsessed by it, right?
Kind of, yeah. I try to get everything I can get my hands on a particular subject. And if I was, I'm serious, if I'm on an airplane, you know, and people want to know, oh, what do you do? If I say I'm an entertainer or I'm a rock guitarist, the whole flight becomes about that.
Right.
But if you ask them, well, what do you do? And they say, well, I'm nothing. I'm a plumber. I go, plumber isn't nothing.
No.
What do you think about elbow joints?
Let's talk about elbow joints for 4 hours.
I want to talk about plumbing. I want to learn about plumbing.
Right.
Or, you know, hedge funds or whatever it is. you know, I find interest is interesting. You ask people what they're interested in, most people can't come up with a significant number of things that they're interested in. And I'm interested in interest itself.
Yeah, I get you. All things. Yeah.
Meta interest.
They're all pieces to a big puzzle.
That's right.
So you know, through your teens and early adulthood, you have many adventures. Most famously, you were punched by Jimi Hendrix. Can you talk about how you took that and how you used that moment, which is quite differently than how most people would after getting smacked around?
Well, first of all, it was Jimi Hendrix, and I looked up to him.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, I didn't understand why he punched me three times, face left, stomach right, face left, and I sat down. And I just thought, like, because I'd read about Chinese boxers, and if they hear about some great boxer, they'll go get their ass kicked by him in order to steal some of their chi.
Right.
So I sat down and I thought, how do I not lose this energetic impulse that just arrived through his fists? And I thought to myself, hey, Pac's a pretty good wallop for a skinny black guy.
Yeah, but the big thing was taking it in and realizing that in some cosmic way, Jimmy was quite the cosmic guy from what I've read.
Absolutely.
He had given you a small amount of his magic.
Maybe that's the case, or maybe I took it. Maybe it was just a fortuitous moment of grace. Because afterwards, I heard people say, somebody tried to beat up Jimmy, we'll kill him. His handlers, and I knew they meant it, and I hadn't laid a hand on him. So I sat there till they closed the place down, about an hour. So the guy with the mop said, listen, I got to lock up, you got to go. And upstairs was a parking lot, and Jimmy was there waiting for me. And he rolled down his window on his Corvette and crooked his finger at me to come over. And I went over and he put out his hands and took my hands, started sobbing and saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry. And I was like, Jimmy, go to bed. It's okay, it's fine. Don't worry about it, I'm not injured, you know? But he wouldn't let go of my hands, literally. I kept pulling him and he wouldn't let go for, it must have been 10, 15 minutes. And then finally he let go of my hands and rolled up the window and drove away. And then my friend Velvet jumped out from behind some doorway he was hiding and it nearly scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, Velvet, who introduced you to Jimmy, I believe.
That's right. Velvet was Jimmy's only guitar student.
Mm-hmm.
It's only... Jimmy was his mentor.
Yeah. So Velvet would learn licks from Jimmy and then he'd run and teach you, right?
Basically, because I lived near Jimmy's house, mm-hmm. apartment in 69 or whenever he had that apartment on 12th Street. And I lived on Jane Street. It was not that far away. So he would call me from a payphone and say, can I come over? And I had a guitar there, of course. And he would play things that Jimmy was teaching him, and I would pick him up, and we would pass the guitar back and forth.
It's an amazing experience. Amazing experience. So yeah. In your teens, if you don't mind, things get very dark.
Do they?
You had to live with a mental condition that seemed to deteriorate your world. Manic depression is what we call it now. But back right. then, you were institutionalized for just being quote-unquote insane.
Well, they called it schizophrenia. They didn't have manic depression or bipolar. You know, I would have manic episodes, and I mean, they were real. I think I had epilepsy when I was a young child because I used to have dazes where time would slow down or speed up. Or I don't know if it would slow down for me and speed up for you or speed up for me and slow down for you. But there were times when time itself, my perception of it changed so radically that I could think 100 thoughts in between every word that you or I spoke. And it was dazzling. I loved it.
And but other people couldn't understand.
Other people weren't privy. So there was no point. There's no point in telling them anything about it. I'm sure other children have these kinds of spells come upon them, and then they just dissuade themselves from believing it after a time because it doesn't meet up with the quote-unquote norm of societal limitations.
Right.
Or it's thought of as an illness. It's a brainstorm, an electrical storm in the temporal lobe, if you have temporal lobe epilepsy. It often leads to a increase in religiosity and intelligence, and you know, it's a brainstorm.
Yeah.
I have brainstorms.
Yeah. And you were institutionalized a couple of times, both in New York and New Jersey. But what I liked about it is that it's you deal with it and you learn to survive and even thrive from it. I kept a quote from the book. It was insane to be insane, and I was sane. It's like you thrived. And here's another quote. While I haven't been to the moon or Everest, I survived two old state mental institutions during the dark ages of treatment.
That's true. Yeah. How many people can say they've been through the one flew over the cuckoo's nest?
Right.
Watch the movie, but that's like kindergarten.
Right. Oh, you know, compared to the reality, right.
Compared to the reality of the building. Or the buildings or the complex that they would, I mean, rich people would throw away their inbred children, put them away. People put away their kids forever and ever. And then there were the true schizophrenics and broke, which is schizophrenos or broken mind.
Right.
From the Greek, broken soul, phrenos. And so they thought I had that, but every time they thought I had that, I cleared up.
thankfully, and got out. But you take it as not a negative or a weight, you know, or a monkey on your back. It's just another adventure. It's just another moment in this thing we call life.
Well, I do remember after Greystone State, which is where I found out later Woody Guthrie passed.
Right. Right. Yeah, Bob used to go visit him there, right?
Yeah, I might have been there then. Who knows? But anyway, they let me out to a drug halfway house that was in the middle of a round-the-clock cleanup, and they handed me a toothbrush, and they said, follow this guy with a broom with the toothbrush to clean the rug. And I did that for about 6 hours, and then I said, no, I'm out of here.
Right.
They all were like, oh, you'll go back to drugs. And I'm like, you're damn right I will.
If you make me do this.
Don't go. And I went all the way home from where it was in Newark to where my parents were then in Montclair, New Jersey. I walked home, which is why I often tell people, you know, they're like, you got a dollar for the bus to Atlanta? I'm like, well, you're going north and Atlanta's south. You ought to be walking
the other way.
You ought to be moving towards your destination no matter what happens.
Right. So you are an internal explorer. Let's talk a little bit about the drugs. And I mean drugs of all kind. It sounds like you're able to keep a handle on it until you couldn't later on. It also sounds like you had an appetite similar to the mythical Keef. If I could, one question on the drug use and how you used it. It seems it wasn't about getting to oblivion, but exploration. Is that fair to say?
Oblivion would have been horrid. Oblivion would have been, you know, the antithesis is what you take is something that will cause oblivion and then fight it with all your might. It's a game of willpower, you know, to take sedatives and stay awake, to take ups and not go running around cutting out word, you know, letters from a newspaper. You know, it's a battle. It's a spiritual war going on.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's what your interest was in most of the taking of drugs, right?
Well, that's probably one of the things that saved me from going down the tubes, you know, standing in the toilet. Mostly drug use is standing in the toilet and pushing the word flush.
Right.
And hoping you don't go down too fast. But, you know, you're going to go down.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to realize that.
Yeah, that takes some time to figure out.
That centripetal force.
It's going to get you sooner or later.
An opposite reaction, and something has to spin out, spin off. And in my case, I always thought, maybe, just maybe if I'm fortunate enough, it'll be some kind of art or music or something will, you know, be the counterpoint to this destructive self-behavior.
Well, that leads to my next question. So, you know, you continue your adventures of all kind, all the while you're learning guitar, mostly by yourself, almost completely solo, right?
Almost completely by myself, that's right. I did not want to learn anybody else's licks. I mean, Jimmy, that was an exception because he was teaching Velvet through his own songs.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, although we did at one point, he made us go out, or made Velvet go out, and then Velvet told me to do it and bought the Mickey Baker Jazz Method of guitar, which is a little slim guitar instruction book, as he was learning jazz stuff, jazz chords, and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into that. But other than that, it was all me on my own. I didn't want to know Clapton's lick, you know, because if it was good, it would end up coming out somehow.
Yeah, and this went on for years. This is not something you did for, you know, 6 months or a year. This went on for several years, right?
It went on until Television was formed.
Right, which is kind of like your first band, right?
Yeah, well, it was my second band. I had formed a band called Crossfire that year, but we only did one gig at the Policeman's Benevolent Association in Queens. But other than that, no, I kept hidden. I played the electric guitar with no amplifier on purpose. I didn't have an amplifier. I didn't know, you know, I didn't have enough money to have an amplifier. And if I had to be a vagabond, I couldn't carry an amplifier around. So I just played a Stratocaster or a Telecaster on electric. And I didn't want anybody to hear me because I was, woodshedding.
Right.
And I was trying to become good. There were so many people who were better than me, and there still are so many people that are better than me at playing guitar. You know, the only difference is that most of their guitars are in the closet, and they've gone off to some plan B, or they're just, and they really did make it, and they're famous, and they're awfully damn good. And there's a certain pantheon, it's like liquor. There's top shelf, and there's nothing beyond top shelf.
You know, if I could, let me ask you two things about that. One is that you the way you play your leads, or the way you record your leads, with the feeling that all of those guitar gods are in the room with you as you actually record it, which
sneaking a look over me.
Yeah, yeah, making sure you do it right.
But yet, that's the standard I want to reach, and so that's the standard I have to pretend, you know, imagine. Pretend is not the right word, but
yeah,
imagine,
right?
Imagine that that's the company I'm keeping while I'm playing.
Yeah. And then the other question is that I want to point out is that you left yourself no plan B.
No, I didn't want a plan B. No, no way. Everybody said, get a plan B, music, you know, you'll never make it in music. And I was like, well, it's already a done deal. So, you know, this is like war again, and to use a metaphor, and you burn your bridges behind you so the troops can't rebel and defect.
Right, right.
You know, because wow. There's always a part of you that wants to just give it a quit.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as 55% wants to go on, you'll go on, you know. So you don't leave yourself those escape routes.
Close them off.
Close them off. That's right.
Wow.
And that way you'll only head in one direction. Even though it may look like you're going in the wrong direction, you'll know where you're going.
If you're paying close attention, yes. Yeah.
Close attention and have some sort of internal compass.
Right, right. So you made it out west. You actually came to L.A., San Francisco, hung out with Led Zeppelin. Keith Moon's story is hilarious. The Stones, getting up with John Lee Hooker. And then you take a fast car across the country to get back to New York because you heard a scene was starting up. But that car wasn't a Lotus that didn't go straight from L.A. to San Francisco. I mean, L.A. to New York. It went meandered to get there, right?
That's right. It wasn't mine, and I hitched a ride, and I don't know how I got the ride. But the guy said, look, I'm going to New York, but I'm going, like, up into Montana, and I'm going down to New Orleans, and I'm going, you know, I'm going all over the place. You have to, if you want to go with me across the country, you have to abide by where I go. And I said, well, that's fine, you know. So we went up to, like, the mountains in Montana or whatever it was, and where, you know, people wore cowboy boots and stuff like that. And we went down to New Orleans where, as it happened, Led Zeppelin were in town, and that's where they were staying while they flew to other places. And we stayed there.
Yeah,
like,
common in the day.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we drove to New York. And on the way to New York, the Mercer Arts Center fell down.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So, I mean, the reason you were going back to New York is because you heard that there was a scene starting up. And you got there, and the Mercer comes tumbling down. I guess the New York Dolls scene kind of morphs into something different, and that leads you to Terry Ork's Chinatown flat, right?
Well, not quite so quickly. I arrived in New York, and the Mercer Arts Center had fallen down, but I quickly found out that Max's Kansas City was the hot spot for everybody.
Right.
Artists, you know, Warhol people, musicians, etc. And the back room, which was this very small space, actually, with the number of tables and booths in it, was like the place to be. And you couldn't get in there just on your good looks alone. So I don't know how I managed to become one of the regulars. I guess I was pretty boy at the time. And so
There is that.
They wanted me around, you know, and so
Wild child probably helps too.
The Wild Child definitely helped. And, you know, I went to, and I had no home. And I, you know, lived with a number of girls and boys and did what I could to survive while playing my guitar unelectrified.
Unelectrified by yourself.
By myself.
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
No. I mean, but how many years is this that you are, you know, woodshedding alone?
Well, 17 to 26. Yeah, 10 years.
That's a long time to just by yourself so that you don't get, let us say, infected by other people's playing. But it does create a certainly a sense of originality.
I would hope so.
Oh, it definitely shows through in your playing. I think that's pretty obvious. So,
yeah, which is why I don't get hired for a lot of gigs, because people want guitarists who don't upset the whatever it is, the apple cart that's going. They're like, the lead vocalist is famous and he wants a guitarist that sounds just, it sounds really good, but like a neutral taste. No, you know, like Jimi Hendrix.
Well, I was going to say, Jimi had that problem a lot.
He had that problem a lot. Yeah, he got kicked out because
several times. Right.
Yeah. I didn't want that to happen. But, you know.
Oh, so from Max's Kansas City, and you know, you sleeping wherever you could sleep, and you know, still partying as hard as you could, you do meet Terry Ork, right?
I met Terry Ork, and he said, "Oh, my roommate just moved out. There's a room in the front of this." He had a loft, apartment with like basically three rooms. It was a walk through, you know, from the front of the street to the back alley. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was a room in the front, so I stayed there. And the deal was that I would provide drugs and companionship, and he would pay all the bills and the rent and everything else.
That's a pretty good deal.
That's a very good deal.
Right.
That's right.
Right,
and he ended up providing most of the drugs anyway.
So it was an even better deal for you, right?
It was even better deal.
So now I would say this is where the electricity really begins. You know, the continuation of practice alone, as we've now determined, is, you know, close to 10 years until the moment came. And that moment appears to be you seeing Tom Verlaine for the first time.
That was the moment. During his second song, and I leaned over to Terry and I said, forget about putting a band together around me. Get the two of us together, because he's missing something, and what he's missing, I've got. And I know I'm missing something, and what I'm missing, he's got. And you've got a lock here.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put the two of us together, you'll have history. You know, you'll have the band you're looking for. Because Terry wanted to create a whole sort of anarchic scene. And his whole idea was Marxist or beyond Marxist.
Oh, okay. Like the Malcolm McLaren thing with the Sex Pistols
exactly.
To try to create that. Mm-hmm.
He wanted to create that and more. You know, he was definitely into film as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, he wanted to create a scene, something beyond democratic, anarchy, I guess.
Well, that's definitely not television. And so you guys saw each other. Right.
At the beginning, we were more like that. We were nuts.
Oh, I have seen some of the YouTube videos of the rehearsals, and when Richard Hell's in the band, and it's pretty crazy.
It was pretty crazy, and it was, to me, it was like the greatest feeling on earth. Like I'd run away and joined a very, a circus that was better than any other circus that I knew about.
Mm-hmm. On earth. I love how you look at a career in rock music as a choice between two circuses.
Yeah. Well, what other circus was there?
You know, there's the dangerous, anything could happen circus, and then there's the Barnum and Bailey circus.
Yeah.
And it seems that you know, every musician comes to that choice, right? The safety net circus, and every musician gets that choice of which one do you want to follow.
That's right. But who buys a ticket to a safety net circus if you can buy one to one that doesn't have it? You don't want people to get hurt, but you want danger. You want thrills and chills.
Well, and at that point, sometimes people do get hurt, but that's just.
Well,
you know, that's the way it is. Yeah. It happens.
I saw the first time I ever ran into or saw Sid Vicious and Nancy, I was like, those two are going down the hard way, and I wouldn't approach them with a 50-foot barge pole.
Right, right. You know. Yeah, it was quite evident, huh?
It was the first like love at first sight, it was death at first sight.
Right. Wow.
It was very sad, actually, to see. And then all of the people who gathered around that scene were the punks of the scene, the punkiest punks of the scene, some of whom are still alive and kicking, happily to say.
Yeah.
Through it all.
So I guess Richard Hell leaves the band. You, Billy, and Fred joined together, and then, you know, television kind of begins to play a lot, and, you know, was one of the first bands, if not the first band, to play at Hilly's Place, CBGB's, right?
Yeah, well, we made the rules, basically. Two bands a night, each plays two sets. That was because we wanted to play more.
Right.
It was kind of based on, an imitation of the Beatles at the Star Club, where they'd have to play five sets a night.
Right.
And that
right,
got
in Hamburg. Right. Mm-hmm.
So it was like that, you know. And in the beginning, I stood in the middle. I was like the George to Richard and Tom.
Yeah, you were kind of, weren't you?
That's exactly how I saw it.
The quiet one. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, quiet there.
right.
I did sing a couple songs.
Yeah. So you guys put two seminal albums together. Marquee Moon, obviously, and Adventure. But then, just as quickly as it all seemed to come together, it kind of fell apart. Yeah.
I think Tom never wanted it to be a band except his band, where we're paid less than him. And he figured that if he left the band, he could make a record for Elektra and get all the money and, pursue his own career since that. I mean, we were very popular in England, so he went to live in England after the first Elektra. Tom Verlaine album.
Right.
And I got to make a third television album, which was Alchemy.
Yeah. So
I had more struggle because he was the lead singer. And obviously the lead singer is going to be given more deference than the other guitar player.
Yeah, the voice is what, you know, non-musicians will gravitate to, always at first.
Keep you off the radio if it's...
if it's not the voice that's needed, right? That too. So, you know,
cause you to turn the knob the other way, it'll keep you off the radio. How the radio works is backwards from what you'd think. It's not because you're good. It's because they won't turn the knob till the commercial comes.
So that's the trick. That is the real trick, is to get that done. So would you say Seymour Stein of Sire was correct when he said you guys wouldn't sell a lot of records, but you guys would be hugely influential?
Yeah.
Yeah. I there's a moment when I was reading the book, and you relay that time you guys are, I think, in the van, and you play the Cars first album, and you just knew you guys were fucked.
Yeah, that's kind of true. Tom said it first, and then I listened, and I was like, you could be right here, because now they have something they can really, marketing and publicity can really get behind. And they can't really get behind us. They don't know what to do with this, although we'd asked them to put out college radio records, and they said college radio doesn't sell records. We asked them to let us make T-shirts, and it would be advertising for the band. And they said, no, we're not in the merchandising business. And, they just didn't know what to do with us.
What?
And they were following the prescient kind of thoughts that we had, so that would have helped.
Well, yeah, because history shows that you know, other bands did that and grew to be quite successful. That you guys were just, again, ahead of your time in so many ways. You know, I wonder, what if television had been able to stay together, if Verlaine could have maybe shared the stage a little more? Do you guys think you would have ruled the new wave 80s?
I don't postulate like that. I don't think like that. I don't wonder about alternative realities.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I have a saying, if you tell the truth, you can remember everything because there's only one storyline.
Right.
If you start telling lies, or if you start fantasizing about what might have been, then you have all these separate storylines going on in your head. And that's going to prevent you from moving forward properly.
I completely agree. I wish more people would recognize that. I know that served me well. I picked up on that in your book, that's, you know, that's how you live life. And yep. It's the easy way. It is by far the easy way. And I know so many people who don't live like that, and they just complicate and make their lives difficult.
And then their lives become miserable. So, you know, there's no point.
Yeah.
Really.
Honesty, the best policy. They're not kidding. So you go off to Bearsville to record your first solo album, Alchemy.
Right.
That sounds like it was a little tough. The drugs really begin to take over your life. And you were also working with a producer, Michael Young, and it doesn't seem like that went the way you wanted it to.
No, it didn't go the way I wanted it to at the time, because he put keyboards on the record. And one day Fred Smith came to me and said, Michael Young's in the control room putting cheesy keyboards on your record, and he's got the door locked. And I went downstairs, and indeed, he had locked the door and was putting these keyboards on various songs. And he wouldn't open the door, no matter. I pounded and pounded, he would not open the door. And so I called the record company, and I said, I want to fire him. And they said, that's fine. You'll have to pay for the next producer that you get, though, because we've already paid him in full. And he called and told the record company, of course, he's a mess, and I'm saving him, you know, I'm saving the record for you guys. And, you know, I don't know how much percentage of truth is in that. I listen to the record now, and I wouldn't change anything about it. Some of the cheesy keyboard sounds don't sound so cheesy today. You know, their day has come and gone and gone and come and come and gone and gone and come and come around the bend, and it's part of the integral structure of the record.
Yeah, I you know, I got to that point, and I went back and listened to the songs. And the funny thing is that I kind of came back to that thought of like, oh, it does have a little bit of that Cars keyboard sound to it, which was kind of big at the time, you know. And I could see where maybe, you know, the songs are great. It's you know, a song is a song. You know, the arrangement and the affectations that you may put around it, you know, might make it work in a moment or not. But, you know, a song is a song. And if it's a good song, it's a good song. And there's some very good songs on that album. But you know, I could see where maybe he was thinking, ah, this would be more commercially acceptable by adding some of those things
right
on there. So then,
yeah. Blame him more.
What's that?
I don't blame him anymore. I've forgiven him a long time ago.
Good. Yeah, and people should go out there and listen to that. It's a good album. It's a very, very, really good album. So,
thank you.
So after Alchemy, as you state in the books, you enter the real depths of depravity from 1980 to 1984. And, you know, I got to say, Richard, you're unbelievably honest in the book. You know, it's
I can't lie.
No, you know, you lay it all out, and you know, you may call out a couple of people here and there, but you know, you point your finger at yourself more than anything else is maybe why something didn't work, or in some cases why maybe things did work or should have worked if you had a little bit more say in there. So right. I kind of think of it. It's a weird thing. I kind of think of it like, you know, you're an ancient ascetic monk searching to become a Buddha, and I also like how you compare this time to your life, and I mean that throughout your whole life, is this, you know, chasing this, trying that, to get the experience to see if it moves you forward, but I like how you compare this time in your life to the Depression of the 1930s. You know, so I'm going to ask you, would you care to talk a little bit about this, or should we just move on to the brightness of the Swedish savior and your adventure in the cold white north?
I don't mind talking about it. To me, there was a whole downturn artistically at that time. I guess it was was Reagan elected or something?
Yeah, he was.
And there was this huge artistic depression, mm-hmm. and I suffered from it. And, you know, hair bands and corporate for a couple of years.
Yeah, I had to live through that myself. But then, as we said, redemption with Field of Fires. I mean, sorry, Field of Fire.
Yeah, well, I got myself, finally, I got myself pulled out of that tailspin and got my feet firmly on the ground. And about 70 days after I got clean and sober, a phone rang in the middle of the night, and it was a friend of mine who had gone to Stockholm to escape his own drug problems. And he said, the first words out of his mouth were, there's a guy over here wants you to make a record for him. Do you want to make a record? And I thought, sure. I had a prayer on my lap that was about, give me a sign. And here the phone rang while it was still, the ink wasn't dry. So I had to say yes.
Right, the universe was talking, huh?
At that point, either it was, you know, Jungian synchronicity, or it was prayers being, the prayer was answered, or who knows, I believe in the efficacy of honest, humble, real prayer. And I think it can move mountains, as it were. The old, if I wanted the Eiffel Tower in my backyard, it would be there tomorrow.
Right, right.
Ups down.
Yeah, and it helped pull you out, put you back on a positive path of, you know, which you've pretty much been on since. I mean, the rest of the 80s and the 90s, you know, you're sober, you're working with people like John Doe of Axe, Matthew Sweet, and then television's revival in 1992, which you stayed until 2007. I guess whenever Verlaine decided to put the thing back together, it seems like.
It wasn't Verlaine, it was Tom's manager and my manager at a gathering talking with each other, and one said, what's Tom, you know, the one guy helping me said, what's Tom doing? And his guy said, no, not much. And he said, what's Richard doing? You know, not much. And why don't we try to get them back together? And that's what happened. And it took about a year of sitting in cafes and drinking coffee and arguing with Tom until we actually decided we would. And then I brought it to my lawyer, who was Clive Davis's son at the time.
Yeah, Fred Davis.
Chopped the record around, mm-hmm. got us the deal with Capitol. And right after the record came out, everything at Capitol changed. And that they dropped six acts. And we were one of the acts, and we were one of the acts that got
the acts. Right.
That's
right. Right, right.
But we started playing live. You know, people wanted to. There were a few festivals and this and that where they wanted us to play, especially this thing called Meltdown. One was curated by David Bowie, and he asked us to play. One was curated by Patti Smith, she asked us to play, and one was done by a band called out of Chicago. I can't remember their name now. My apologies to them. I keep thinking turtle. Tortoise,
right.
Tortoise was turtle was a nickname given to me because I wore turtlenecks when I was a teenager. That's not in the book, but
hey, we're making news today, folks.
You know, so there you go.
So then, you have The Cover Doesn't Matter in 2001, Radiant Monkey right. in 2007, Jamie Nevert's Story in 2009, and then last year, Rosedale, right?
Yeah, and Lodestones, which came out somewhere in between, but never got pressed into CDs or made into a record.
So I have a feeling you look at the world more in impressions than in hard realities. You think in magical terms, like your adventures with Velvet and the use of the power of wish, your absorption of Jimmy's punch and how you think about intoxication or as you're being committed in a psych institution as adventures. Is that a fair description of your personal philosophy?
Yeah, except if I actually, I mean, I live by impressions, but not as deeply as Van Gogh.
Not maybe as a painter, but, you know, you still are an artist and you look at the world not in those hard realities of, you know, like analytical people do, you know, more in the softness of it.
I can be analytical too, but I'm not. I mean, I do believe in magic, and I do believe in the power of the wish and the will and the soul, you know, and not everybody has that capacity, though. The gifts are not given out indiscriminately, and they're not given out equally. Or, you know, they all people are born equal. Well, they're in some regards they are, and in some regards they're born as deeply different as a rock is from a potato.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The attributes are spread like fairy dust across the entire human population.
And you know, most people think that because Einstein thought of V equals MC squared, that they're that intelligent. You know, they know the formula. They know the formula. So they think that that's what's going on. And they don't see that those are the mountain peaks of humanity and that there are not that many of them.
Right.
That
right.
high, you know, the Mount Everest of humanity or even the lower peaks. Most are in the plains happily.
Right.
Daydreaming away watching pseudo-life television. Where the limbic brain system can't tell the difference between an experience seen and an experience experienced.
Felt, right, right. Last question.
Okay.
Of all the people you have met or worked with, and you mentioned this ability in the book several times, who do you think rose above the rest with that elusive X factor?
Oh, I'm not going to answer that because there's, as I said earlier, look at a bar. You've got house brand, you've got this, you've got middle shelf, and you have top shelf. And there's more than one thing on top shelf. And there's no single, like, exemplary oneness that's like nothing else ever will touch it or will touch it or in any endeavor in life. There's always going to be people that are excellent, and there's going to be more than one of them. And often ideas are brought out simultaneously in different parts of the world by different people. So I can't answer that. Yeah, I do know that I recognize the elusive it, and that some people have it in greater or larger quantities than others, and some people have it, you know, and but I can't say one. I can't pick out one person.
Well, Richard, I really appreciate all your time today. It's a fantastic book. I really enjoyed reading it, and thanks for being with us here at Deeper Digs in Rock.
My pleasure.
So, has this guy seen some shit or what? Thank you, Richard Lloyd, for sharing some of your special brand of craziness with us. Once again, Richard's got a great memoir out, Everything is Combustible. And if you type everythingiscombustible.com into your web browser, that will take you right to it. Do it. Go read this one. You can thank us later. Thanks for stopping by, diggers. You are brilliant, courageous, and attractive, all of you, and we expect you back soon. I'm Christian Swain, and this has been Deeper Digs in Rock, a production of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Keep up the rockin'. Bye for now. To help right the wrongs of social injustice? Oxfam America works with people in more than 90 countries to save lives, develop long-term solutions to poverty, and campaign for social change. And we do it with the help of our friends in the music world. The Beatles were Oxfam supporters back in the day, so were the Stones. And through the years, musicians and music fans have helped Oxfam push hard to work for a just world without poverty. Folks like Radiohead, Coldplay, Pearl Jam, DJ Shadow, and many, many more have encouraged their fans to join the effort. You can too. Go to OxfamAmerica.org to learn how you can help.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. All quotes performed by actors unless noted. Playlists can be found at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Please purchase these great and important tracks. All songs, clips, and references can be found on our show notes. Please visit rnrap.com for more information.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
With one of the best savings rates in America, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than choosing Slash to be in your band.
Next up for lead guitar. You're in.
Cool.
Yep, even easier than that. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.